I'm going to continue one more lecture on Java, and this time we're going to start by talking about more about the windowing system, and that's implemented in the Java classes that are in the Abstract Windowing Toolkit, otherwise known as the AWT. So far, some of the things that we've seen are pretty much, we're all in the graphics class. We saw how to draw text strings and how to draw shapes of different sizes, and how to respond to mouse events. That's just part of the Abstract Windowing Toolkit. It's only one part. There are other parts of the Abstract Windowing Toolkit having to do with making frames, putting in buttons, text fields, and a lot of other structured components. I used the top next button, right? Yes. So the main class for all of the things that you put in the windowing system is called component. And there's a hierarchical system of how you can have subclasses of component that go into the windowing system, and also how you can layer them so that you can divide up the windowing system, which is one component, into a set of smaller components, and then define finally the smallest things which go inside this nested system of components are things, concrete things like buttons and text fields that you actually want to appear on the window. So some of the programming that you do in the Abstract Windowing Toolkit is just deciding how you're going to structure the set of classes that are going to handle what appears on the window. And one way that you do that is deciding which kinds of classes will handle which parts, and also just how to break it up into parts and have different classes handle different parts. Most of the classes that we work with in windowing are descended from, as subclasses from component. Not all of them are. They're the menu classes. They're off on the side in the hierarchy. The other part of the windowing system is not only defining what the various components will be, but saying how they're going to appear with respect to each other in the window. This is the so-called layout, and there's a set of layout managers to help structure how the components are going to appear in the window. You don't do this at a very fine-grained level in which you say things like, what pixel locations to put buttons at, the way you did in the graphics part. In the graphics part, it's very detailed. You give pixel locations for things. In the rest of the windowing system, you just give an abstract scheme called a layout that says how the components are to be added in a general kind of way, and you never say explicitly where they're supposed to be. So it's a higher level type of way to specify how the components are going to appear on the window. So how does it look that you put things on the window? And essentially the main method is called add. So suppose you wanted to add a button to your applet window. Well, the applet is a subclass of component. It's actually a subcomponent, container, panel, and then applet. And since it is, you're allowed to put other components in your applet. In particular, suppose you wanted to put something specific like a button. There's a class for buttons, and you, in the normal way, you would declare a variable b of type button, and you would use the button constructor to make one. And the various constructors, of course, have different arguments for buttons. The constructor argument is the text that you want to appear on the button to label the button. So once you have a component like a button, then you just use this add method to say, I want this to actually appear on my layout. So this is what you do. This is equivalent to those graphics methods like draw string or draw rectangle or draw image. It's what actually makes it appear on the window. And of course, you will be using a layout manager to say, as you add various components, to say how they're going to be organized on the window. So some of the components that you're going to be putting in the window, like buttons, are actually going to have actions. People can click on buttons, and you want to be able to do something to respond to it. So before, we talked about how to respond to general mouse events in the graphics area. There's a similar event handling mechanism in the rest of the abstract windowing toolkit. In this case, what you have is the action method, which is going to say what your program is supposed to do for any of various events that can happen during the execution of the program. So the user clicking on the button is an example of such an event, and you would write in this an action method that would say what is the program to do in the event of that button being clicked. This is a pictorial example of the main part of the component hierarchy for the abstract windowing toolkit. So component is the parent class of all this part of the class system. And as direct children of the parent class, first look off to the left here. Can you see the mouse there where I'm moving it? I realize some of you can't really see that screen very well. But from on the left half of the page, going across this line that's just directly below component, we have individual components that appear directly on the windowing system, like checkbox, button. Text component is actually broken into two classes, text field for one-line things and text area for larger areas, scroll bars, and labels. So these are the very specific things that are components that can appear on the window. Off in the right half here, we start with Canvas, and Canvas is the part that has all the graphics methods that we've been talking about so far. So if you want to have part of a window in which you use those graphic methods to draw shapes or draw strings, then you would make that part be a canvas. And then in that part, you can use all the graphics methods. And then finally, on the right here, we have a subclass called Container. And everything that's in this class are components which can themselves hold other components. So this is the part of the abstract windowing toolkit where you have an area which you want to break up into sub-areas and have different components in different areas. Yes. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. What word are you saying before class?
Inbuilt.
Ah, yes. These are all built-in classes. Yes. I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear that word. So containers come in two sorts, and the first is panel, and this is what applets are, and everything that's a panel is going to have things which appear in the current window. So an applet has that property because the browser has already put up a window. It defines the part of the browser window that the applet is going to draw in as a panel, and then the applet is a subclass of that. So it's an area within the current window. Now, it's also possible, in addition to the browser window for an applet, to put up a separate window or a separate frame, sometimes it's called. So it would come up as another window in the style of whatever windowing system you have. Like, it'll look like an X Windows, or if it's in a Macintosh system or a PC, it'll look like one of their windows, separate from the browser window. Now, under that, there are two sorts. Frame, which is the sort of general what you'd expect from a window in the windowing system of your workstation that has usually a border of some sort and a menu bar and all the general components that you expect of windows to have in a workstation windowing system. The other sort are dialog boxes, and they are individual pop-up windows of a very simple sort where you just have a message and a button to click. These are the kinds of boxes that you get when you get errors of various sorts. It'll say, Netscape couldn't allocate 8-bit color map or something, and you have to click OK, saying that you read that error message. So that's sort of a general overview of the classes and how you're going to be putting things into the windows. But now let's talk about, in a little more detail, about some of the individual kinds of components. So first we have here the very simplest ones, which are labels and buttons. And what labels do is just put up some text. So this is quite helpful to put text up in various places on the window if you want to give titles or give instructions for what people are supposed to fill in, boxes or what the buttons mean and things like that. So there is a constructor for this class called label, and what you give it is just the string that you want to appear, and you can add it to a window with the add method like all the others. And then we talked about buttons. Here's an example of adding two more buttons with different strings to label those buttons. And we haven't actually defined yet how these things are supposed to be laid out, but it turns out that the simplest layout is called a flow layout, and just whatever order you add things in, that's the order from left to right across the window that the AWT system will add your components to the window. Another kind of component is a checkbox. And here's an example where you're adding three checkboxes to a window. And again, the checkbox constructor has as its first argument the string which is supposed to be labeled beside the checkbox. So the checkbox is supposed to be an on-off toggle, and the user is supposed to be able to actually check these little diamonds, and they will either appear off or they will appear on. And what you give us the argument will appear beside the checkbox. Now, I actually see there's a typo here. Right after the string blue, that right parenthesis should not be there. It should be over after true. I don't know if you have your copy to correct that. In this particular use of checkbox, the constructor is supposed to have three arguments. That's why the parenthesis is in the wrong place. And the first argument, as usual, is the string that appears there. The second argument is actually something called the checkbox group, which we'll talk more about on the next page. And the third argument is the initial value of the checkbox. So you can have the checkbox appear as if it's checked to start with by giving true to this argument. Now, in addition to constructors, checkboxes have other methods that you can work with. There is an event as well, which we have when somebody checks it. But just in general, you can, from your Java program, check to see whether the checkbox is on or off by using a method called getState. So if you had a checkbox called CB and you added it to layout, somewhere in that program, you're allowed to test the value of the method cb.getState, and that will return true or false depending on whether the checkbox is checked or not. Now, in the set of checkboxes on the previous slide, the user was allowed to have any number of checkboxes be true. But sometimes you want to have a set of checkboxes in which only one of them is allowed to be marked true, because you want the user to make exactly one selection. And sometimes that's called radio buttons. In Java, the way you do that is by creating a checkbox group. So you have a set of checkboxes. If they're in one group, then they're only allowed to have one of them be checked. If the user tries to check off a second one, then the first one will go false, so that only one of them is ever checked at a time. So how you do that is you declare and create a checkbox group. Here in this example, I've used the variable CBG used the constructor checkbox group to create a new one with no arguments. Then, as I create a set of checkboxes, there are three of them in this example, the second argument will be CBG, the name of the checkbox group. So all these three checkboxes will be in the same group. And then finally, I can add those three checkboxes. Checkboxes which are in a checkbox group, you can also use the method getState that we talked about on the previous slide. But in addition, on the checkbox group itself, you can use a method called getCurrent, which tells you which is the one checkbox which is currently checked, if any. So that's a convenient way to do that. So that's just a few of the specific kind of components that you can put into your windowing area. There are text fields and text areas, and I am going to show an example of that in a moment. Text field is a single line where users can enter text. A text area has a number of lines, usually which is scrollable, where the user can enter a large amount of text. Oh, and also you can either you may also display text in the text fields and text areas. Two other kinds of things are choices and lists. And choice gives you, they're kind of similar. Choice gives you a menu where the user can select a particular item. So there will be like when you click on it, there will be like a pull-down menu or a drop-down menu, and the user can slide the mouse to select a particular item. List is similar, except that it's the list items, the choice items are put in a scrollable window, and the user just clicks on the one they want to select. So I'm not going to give examples of that, but we have examples of that in the Java resources that you have on your web page. Let me just say that the main difference between these two, or one of the main differences, is that in both of them, you can add items that users want to select from during the execution of the program, but in list, you can delete items as well. So list, you can change the contents of the list during the execution of the program if you want to do that. And finally, there's a class called Scrollbar, where you can put up your own scroll bars with little sliders that can select different values. And this is distinct from the scroll bars that automatically come with things like text areas. This is a scroll bar that you control what are the values that it ranges over. You have to put up your own labels and whatever it's going to be controlling. On the next slide, we do have some more about text fields. Here's an example of creating a new text field with the text field constructor. You can put some initial text into the text field, or you don't have to. You can have a null string. Nothing will display. And you can say how many characters wide you want the text field to appear. It's always just one line. You can change the text that's displayed by using the method setText. And if the user types in, you can find out what they typed by using the method getText. And you can get an event as the user types, they can correct and so on. But when they finally hit character turn, then you can get an event that lets you know when to go and use the method getText to find out what they typed. If you only want to display text and you don't want to allow the user to type, there's a method called setEditable, which allows you to control that. So if you say setEditable is false, then the user is not allowed to edit the field, and you're using that text field only to display text and not to allow the user to type in. So you have a lot of control over all those attributes. Now I'm just going to briefly mention some of the other types of components. Canvas is what you draw on using the graphics methods. We've already talked about that actually in some detail. But let me just briefly mention the other classes, frame and dialogue. Frames are what create new frames, sometimes called a pop-up frame, that's going to be a new window in the windowing system. And its constructor, you give a title of the that's going to appear on the top of the menu bar. Then frame is a container, so you can define it hierarchically just like you would a panel. Inside the frame is handled just like a panel, where you can put other things like buttons and so on and create separate areas to put things. But in addition to the normal things that a panel would have and adding components, you have the ability to put menus and menu bars at the top of the frame. So there's a whole set of methods to define what the items are going to be on the menu and what the actions will be when the user clicks on that particular menu item. And it's really quite easy to add those. You just add those in a similar way that you add components to the main part of the frame, to the panel part of the frame. So here's the mention of menu bars and menus. Here's the dialog box, which is, as I mentioned before, a much simpler thing than a frame. Essentially, all you give it is the string to list and what is the and there's one button which the user clicks on or to answer what you're supposed to do about this particular error. I mean, dialog boxes are usually used for reporting on error messages, and the user gets to click on what to do, or for issuing a warning or some other action. So now we discuss a little bit what the action, how to handle the actions that might be generated by some of these components. Unlike mouse and keyboard events, where for mouse and keyboard events, there were a whole set of defined event names, so that you gave a specific event handling function called mouse down or mouse drag. You had a specific one. In this case, you're going to have one event handling function, which is going to handle the events for all the different components. And that method is called action. And you are going to define the action method to handle events from all of the components that you put in your frame that have actions that need to be handled, that have events that need to be handled. Now, there may be some question about exactly where to define the action function, because you may have a component which has some subcomponents, and one of those may have some subcomponents, and way down in there may be a button. And the button will have an event, and you can put the action method that handles that button at various places in the component hierarchy as it appears in the window. So you can put the action event right down in the code that's put up the button, or some other component which contains the subcomponent that has the button in it. And the Java system will use the action method to handle that button that is closest to the button in the hierarchy. The action method has, in general, two arguments. The first is an argument of type event. And this class, event class, has an instance variable called target, which will be the object that caused the event. You can think of it as a reference to the object that caused the event. So, for example, if you have more than one button, you can use this argument, this target, to determine which button caused the event. This other argument is listed as being of type object, which is the most general type you can have, because it varies depending on what the component is. So I can't give a real specific description of that. So here's an example showing how to create an action event, one way to create the action method, to handle events from a set of buttons. So suppose we have buttons like we did in the earlier slide, labeled red, green, and blue. And they have been added to a component. So we can define an action method with the argument, the event argument EVT. And the first thing we do is it's possible that this is part of a program in which you're going to have events from different kinds of things. Like you may have buttons, you may have checkboxes, a lot of things which are going to cause events. So the first thing to do is take event.target and see which kind of component created this event. So we test if event.target is an instance of buttons. And this particular action method is only handling events from a set of buttons. Now in this case, what we choose to do is call a method called changeColor with the other argument, and we're going to convert it to a string because, as it happens, in the particular case of buttons, that general argument called of type object that returns is the string that labeled the button that caused the event. So down here, there's another method called changeColor, which takes a string, and you can test if the string equals which of the labels for the three buttons, red, green, and blue, it is, and you can do some action based on which button was caused the event. So that's one way to distinguish, in the case of buttons, which one caused the event. But in general, you can also use the event.target reference to distinguish which component caused the event as well. So here's another example showing a similar kind of thing. In this case, there's just two buttons, a button called change to red, a button called change to blue. They're both added in the init function. Then the action method tests to see, it's just like the other one, it tests to see if event.target is an instance of button. And if so, it causes change color, except that the argument to change color is given as a reference to the button instead of the string that labels it. So you pass event.target to change color, and change color can test to see if the button B, which caused the event, is equal to either of the buttons, button 1 and button 2, that were created up here. So this is the use of equality to test whether two variables actually have a reference to the same object, to tell which button caused the event. Are there any questions about that? Yes. Oh, this is supposed to be two equal signs as well. Very good. Another typo. I guess we're recording this, so these typos are recorded for posterity. I don't have to write them down. We'll sort them out. Yeah, because one equal sign is assignment, and two equal signs is the test for equality. And you may have noticed in the previous slide that if you wanted to see if two strings had the same value, you had to use the method called equal. Because equal would see if they were actually a reference to the same object, to the same string object. But the method called equals tests to see if there are possibly two different strings which have the same value, the same set of characters as their definition. So the final part is after we've added components and talked about how to create an action method which is going to handle events from those components, is to use a layout manager to say how the components are supposed to appear on the page. So as we mentioned, you don't lay components out by hand in pixel space. You have a set of five layout managers which are provided for you, which have general strategies for how the components are going to be laid out in the space. And there are two reasons to do this, at least. One is just that it's a higher level thing. It's quite tedious to have to figure out with pixels where to put things, and it's also quite difficult to change. And the other is that for use, in particular with browser systems and applets, the user can resize the browser. The components might appear in a different order. It's very hard to control exactly the appearance of the layout in general, and a layout manager will just have a general scheme to try to lay things out and make it fit what the size of the browser window is. So there are five layout managers which are provided. Presumably there will be more custom layout managers provided as classes for Java are created. The way you do provide a layout is there's a method called setLayout in which you give it a constructor for whichever type of layout you want to have. As an example, a flow layout. So in addition to flow layout, another kind of layout is called border layout. And actually, I find this kind of layout quite handy. It has five cells called north, south, east, and west, the four on the borders, and the fifth one is called center, and it's in the middle. So when you use the add method to add components to something which is under a border layout, you, in addition to saying what you're going to add, you give a string which says which area of the border layout to put it in. So, for example, if you say add north, a text field with some title, it would put it up at the top, and it would take as much space, it would make a bar kind of, or take as much space at the top as it needed to fit whichever component you said to put there. Then if you wanted to put something on the bottom, you could say add to south and put some other text field. Usually people put status messages and things in the south part of their window. You can also add things to east and west border. It'll take up however much space you want. If you leave any of these out, it's fine. It just doesn't take up any space for that particular part of the border. Then whatever space is left over is given to the center panel. So if you have something big that you want to appear either next to something small or above or below something small, this is a good way to do it because the small thing can be put in a border panel or a border part and it will only take up as much space as it needs, and then all the rest of it will be devoted to your big thing which you should add to the center. And of course, if you create a new frame, this is the layout that will be used to create the borders that usually appear on a frame. So here's a brief description of the other four layout managers. Flow layout is the simplest, and it's also the default layout manager. And it assumes you just use the simple add method, and whatever order you put the components in, it flows them into the page in order from left to right, until there's no more room, and then it goes down to the next area and flows them in from left to right. And it just takes as much room for each component as it feels is necessary for, you know, a button or a text field or whatever. It has some default size that it tries to make things to fit them in. A grid layout is a much more highly structured thing. Basically, it's in a dividing up the space into an array of spaces, each of which is an equal size. So it's a two-dimensional layout. You say how big it is, like n by m, how many rows and how many columns. Then in each component, as you add them to the grid layout, it puts them in an order from left to right. But unlike the flow layout, where each component might differ in size, in the grid layout, each one is exactly the same size, so that it has an array-like appearance where the rows and columns line up. You can also have actually borders so that it looks like a table with lines in between the rows and columns. A grid bed layout is the most general in customizing the position and size of the components that you're laying out. What you do is you set up a set of constraints between the various components. Like you can say that there's a constraint on two particular components that they have to appear side by side, or that their tops have to line up. So you set up a set of constraints, and the grid bag layout manager tries to do its best to satisfy all those and to fit everything in. So a grid bag layout is sort of the most complicated to use, and I found that the Core Java book has a very good description. And I think also the Battle and Battle book has a good description of grid bag layout. Excuse me. Now, so far, all these layout managers that we've talked about are about different strategies for laying out components in space. A card layout is how to define a bunch of components that essentially take up the same space, but which only one of them shows at a time. So card layout talks about how to lay out things in time. So suppose that you have three windows, and you want only one to appear at a time, and you want the user to be able to click at a button and change which one is appearing. You could define that as a card layout. Each one of those would be a panel in the card layout. But in the Java program, there's a method called show, and you would only show one of the panels at a time. So you can switch between different panels at different times in the Java program. Here's just a little more detail about flow layout. You are allowed to, just illustrating the kinds of things you can do. You need to look up in the Java hierarchy if some of these details for some of the other layouts, but you're allowed to make sure that all the rows line up to the left or the center or the right. You're allowed to give extra arguments which talk how many pixels of space, these arguments are called H-gap and V-gap, appear between the rows, between the objects from top to bottom and the objects from left to right. So similar things are true of the other layouts. The other thing that when you're using layout managers is that you can use them just like components in a hierarchical fashion. So here's an example showing how that would work out. So suppose that you, at the top level in your applet, said use a grid layout that only had one row and had three components. So it's essentially a 1x3 array. So you would create this new grid layout by saying 1x3, and then you can give, again, the number of pixels, which are supposed to be the horizontal gap and the vertical gap. Then you use the method setLayout to say that that's the layout which is supposed to apply to this particular component. Now, what are the three things that you're going to put into this 1x3 array. Well, suppose that in the first one we want to add some simple component like a button, but in the other two cells of the grid layout, we want to have a more complicated layout. We can write a class, in this case it's called My Subpanel class, which would extend a panel, which would have control of just that part of the window where the other components are supposed to appear. So My Subpanel class extends panel. You would create a constructor, and it would have another layout to suppose it was a grid layout that was 2x2, and it would go on and define what the components were that were to appear in that layout. Then up here, where we defined the 1x3 layout, in the first component we could add the button. In the other two components we could add two different instances of this 2x2 subpanel that we defined in that class. So in general, when you're breaking up your window area into smaller portions, you may want to go off and define a class which is going to handle the layout of each of the sub-portions that you define, unless it's a simple component like a button. So next we have an example illustrating this to show you sort of how this all fits together in a piece of code. And this example divides the applet space into two parts, and one is going to be a graphics part, which is going to be a canvas, and that's simple enough that we're not going to define a separate class to control that. And the other part is going to be a more complicated area of the window, and so we are going to define a class that's going to handle that. So in the definition of this class, it's called PictureTime. It's an applet. It's going to have one variable called control, which is going to be an instance of a class that we're going to define. We called it ControlPanel. We also have an instance variable called DisplayCanvas, which is an instance of the class Canvas, which is something that comes, it's a Java built-in class. And that's the part where we can use any graphics methods that we want. So here is a continuation of the code for the main applet. After the declaration of those two instance variables to have the two parts of the window, we have an init function which is going to set the layout to be a grid layout that's 1x2, and it's going to create and add the two components that we want to add here. So to create a new canvas, we just call the built-in canvas constructor, and we can do various graphics functions, including set background. We can make its color be blue. Then, if we want to, for the other part of the window, we create a new control panel by calling the constructor called control panel from the class we're going to define. Then we add them in the order that we want to appear in the grid from left to right, so that the canvas will be on the left and the control will be on the right. That's the order in which we added them. And finally, we have this sort of anomalous method which is provided for use with all components, where you can call a method called inset, and it will define how to put pixels of space around the edge of the layout. So it essentially makes whatever you're defining be inset from the frame in which it appears. Now, only one other method is going to appear in this part of the applet, and that's a method that's going to talk about what to do with the canvas. And in this particular case, we wanted to have a very simple example that would fit on a few slides. So the only thing we're doing on the canvas, we're not drawing anything very complicated, we're just going to change the color. So we made a method called changeCanvasColor. It takes as an argument a string, and it has a set of predefined strings. If the value of the string is equal to one of these predefined sets, and this was written by Miriam Espirley, who chose Turkey, San Diego, and Syracuse as the strings, it changes the background color depending on which string you give it. So notice that what I do is, so my canvas is called display canvas, and so I say display canvas, and I use the method set background with whatever color I want. So this changes the color of the canvas. So far, the applet doesn't do anything, right? It just puts up a canvas. It puts up in the right-hand part of the panel whatever we're going to define in this other class. So let's look at its definition next. These are out of order for how I like to explain it. So let's define this class called control panel. So this extends panel, and notice that it doesn't extend applet. This is just a separate class. It's in the component hierarchy, and so all it does is extend panel. Now I have one instance variable which I called outer parent, and this is where I'm going to keep track of a reference to the applet that is going to use this class. Here is the definition of the constructor. It's a method called control panel, and it takes as an argument something called target, and I expect the target to be a reference to whoever calls this. And so the first statement here records the target argument into this instance variable called outer parent. Now it's going to go about defining what actually goes into this part of the window. So it's going to use a grid layout that's 3x1. So it's vertical, has three objects set up in a vertical fashion with and you can set the background color of that panel. And then it's going to put in create and add three buttons into the three spaces of the grid. So it creates a button called T, it adds T. It can set the foreground and background color of the button. And so the foreground color will be the color of the text, and the background color will be the color that the button actually appears. So if we go ahead, I don't show all the code, to create other buttons called D and S, which have different text and different colors. Now on the previous slide, we have the rest of this, which is the action method, which if a button is clicked, it says what to do. So if a button is clicked, finally something will happen, which is that Java will, interpreter will execute this action method. It tests to see if the event.target argument is an instance of button, and if it is, it passes the string argument to the method changeCanvasColor, which appeared in the applet that calls this class, that creates this class. And we can reference that by using the variable outer parent, which has a reference to the applet. So there's a method in the applet which changes the color of the canvas. In the control panel, there are actions or events generated by the button. And what you can do to handle the button is to call a method in the applet which can change the color of the canvas. All right. this sort of covers the basics of what the are in the abstract windowing toolkit. And to sort of finish off this Java section, I'm going to go to the next section. And tell you a little bit about I/O and the network, how to connect to something across the network. This is not quite the version that I want. I want the image version. I don't know why I'm not getting that other choice over there to click on to get the image.
Which number do you want?
It's top 10. Oh, but this is, oh, this is already the slide. No. I want to start on slide. I'm going to skip threads. I'm essentially going to go to 12. Oh, that came up fine. It's just that I have to wait till I click on something for
to
see what.
I'm going to look at that.
Okay. I'm having trouble with this also. Okay. So in the next section of your notes, there is the fourth section talks about a variety of topics, including multi-threading, which is built in and quite easy to use in Java. I'm going to skip that part. We talked about how to do a single thread. You can create more than one thread. And, in fact, you know how to create more than one thread by just having more than one thread variable. But we'll skip the part that talks about sort of parallel constructs if the threads need to interact. So let's go to the section on some useful basic Java classes. I'm going to go through this part rather quickly as well. There's just I want you to get a feel for what's in here so that you can look things, if you need something like that, you can look it up in your text or in your Java hierarchy and see more, get more details. So we mentioned that there is a class called Object, which is the most general class you can have. It's the sort of root of the class hierarchy tree. And so any Java class has object as its ultimate parent. And there are a few methods associated with the class object, which therefore can apply to anything that you create as an object with a small o, because it will be a child of this class object with a capital O. Clone is to make copies of things. We talked about equals, to compare two objects to see if they have the same value. You can get a class descriptor. Many classes give a method called toString, which says how to convert the value of that of an object of that class to a string that can be printed out. Wait and finalize to code to perform whenever the object is deleted or disposed of. And there are other methods in which you can talk about what the class is of the object that you have. And we talked about using instance of. There's also a method called getName, which will get the name of the class of the whatever object you have. The simple types in Java, things like int and float, are not classes per se. They're primitive types. They're built in. But there are times when it would be really nice to use some of these standard methods on things of primitive type, like converting to a string. And in that case, there are wrappers, so-called wrappers, where you can convert an object of primitive type to the equivalent object, the class, so that you can use some of these standard methods on that. In some of the examples, we saw particular instances of the java.lang.math class. Just want to assure you that this class has pretty much the standard mathematical functions that you might expect: exponent, cosine, sine, ceiling. We saw examples of using the random number generator and using floor to convert to the next lowest integer. We talked about examples with the date class. And I want to just, we've used strings quite a bit, but I just wanted to say a few more words about the string class and what kinds of methods you can use on strings. Basically, whenever you create a string or have a variable that has a value that's a string, that string is a fixed length and you can't change it. It's what they say is not mutable. It's just created and essentially sits there. So if you wanted to have a string that was, if you had an existing string, for example, and you wanted to change one character in it, you wouldn't go in and somehow assign to that one character and make it different. What you would do is take the string, the existing string, and just cut it up into pieces using this substring method and indexing, and put it back together using concatenation to make a new string that was what you wanted. Okay? So there are times, though, when you want to have space allocated for a string where you can increase and decrease the length of the string. So there's a class provided for that as well, and that's the string buffer class. So in the string buffer class, you say what there's a fixed maximum size. That's essentially the amount of storage that's going to be allocated for strings. But you can create small strings. You can append to them. You can change characters in the middle of the string and so on. So these are the mutable strings with variable size. And here's an example using the string buffer class on showing how to reverse, how to take an existing string and create another string which is has the characters reversed. In Java, we also talked about using arrays, and you can create arrays, but once they're created, you can't change the size of the array during the running of the program. Excuse me. So at the time that you call the array constructor, it essentially allocates space for that number of elements, and that's exactly what you're going to get during the lifetime of the program. So if you want, though, something like an array that can change size over the lifetime of the program, again, there's another class provided for that, and that's the vector class. So essentially, the vector class is just one-dimensional, but of course, the elements can be arbitrary objects, so you can create more complicated structures by having the elements be more complicated objects. And what you do is, when you create a vector, you give it what's called the initial capacity. And then as you append things to the vector or to create new items in the vector by assigning to the indices, if you run out of space, it will create more space for you in some sort of increment. And you can actually control that by setting the initial size and by setting the size of the increments. So that's how to get essentially dynamically sized arrays. Here are some details about how to, what are the methods in which you can index into vectors. And finally, there is also a useful data construct class called a hash table. This is very similar to what are called associative arrays in Perl, where instead of like arrays and vectors, where you index into the array or vector by giving integer subscripts. In a hash table, you index into the structure by giving a keyword. So you can assign values to particular keywords, and if you look up a particular keyword, you can get out the values that's assigned to it. So that's also a quite useful structure. So the final topic, I wanted to say a little, give some details about doing I/O and in accessing files across the network. And the first thing to talk about when you talk about networking and I/O in Java is to talk about streams. So essentially in Java, all of I/O and accessing distributed resources is unified into one concept called a stream. And a stream is abstractly just a sequence of bytes. And you can get different forms of I/O or network access depending on where the source of the stream is and where the destination is. So for example, you can read from a file and put it into memory by having the source of the stream be a file and the destination of the stream be some variable in memory. So it's all unified under this concept that you're going to have a sequence of bytes that you can read and write to, or that you can send across the network to some other program or to some other file. So the basic I/O streams are called input stream and output stream. And these are the simplest, these have the simplest access methods of all of the kinds of streams that you can have. A stream is abstractly a sequence of bytes, and essentially what you can do with input streams and output streams is you have a function which can read a byte, and you have on an input stream, and on an output stream you have a method that can write a byte. So you just keep writing bytes to an output stream. There's also methods skip what's the next available byte and close. And you can read and write arrays of bytes. Now these particular methods are what they call blocking on the read and write for data transfer. That is, if you try to read a byte from a file, your Java program doesn't proceed until that byte actually arrives. Or if you try to write, then, which is more important, you don't proceed until that's actually been written. But there's a whole set of these input streams. So the root of the hierarchy is the simple one called input stream, and there's a simple similar hierarchy for output streams, which I don't show here. But as children of input stream, we have different kinds of input streams which have more specific methods available, which have to read and write, or in this case input streams, to read from the input stream. For example, one of the kinds of input streams that you can have is a file input stream, and there are standard Unix file I/O methods which are available to read lines, to read characters, whatever methods are available to read from things of type file input stream. So that is a useful one. Now another really neat thing is that one of the child classes of input streams is called filter input stream, and all of the kinds of filter input streams have some special properties. And those special properties are that you can use the constructors of the filtered input stream to convert something of basic type input stream into a more complicated stream. And so you can layer these and keep converting them. And essentially what happens is that in the background, Java will connect up the read method of the input stream to the read method of the filtered input stream, so that when you read a filtered input stream, it will use the read method of the basic one. But it will also allow you to have more complicated methods according to whatever functionality you may want. So there are a lot of useful ones. One of them is buffered input streams. And instead of waiting to read or write a character off the, or a byte off of the basic input stream, it will create a buffer to read and write out of so that you get better performance, a memory buffer. This thing called data input stream is nice because it has a whole set of methods to, in this case, read data according to more complicated formats, higher level constructs. So there's a method to read an integer, to read a floating point number. The only thing to be careful about, oh, you can read a line, which is really handy. You can read long ints. The only thing to be careful about is the methods in data input stream that reads a character, don't forget, is going to be a 16-bit character because Java has Unicode, whereas if you're reading from a file, a character will only be 8-bit. And so when you, if you just read a file one by one using the read care that's in data input stream, you'll get what appears to be every other character. So that's the only sort of glitch that you have to watch out for. Otherwise, these are really handy functions that will either read whatever's next in the file as an integer or as a float or whatever it is you want. Line number input streams does what you suspect. It adds line numbers. Pushback allows you to put things back onto the input stream to read them at a later time. So you can nest these together. You can start with an input stream, you can convert it to a buffered input stream. Here's an example of code which assumes that you have an input stream called IS, and you're going to give it as an argument to the constructor for buffered input stream, so that will create buffers for it, and then you give that as an argument to the constructor for data input stream, so that now you can use these more structured methods to read from that stream. So let's go on to the networking section and talk about how to use input streams to read and write things from files and how to use them to access data or files associated with a URL across the network. So we'll talk about just using URL to access a document on a web server. We'll just also there are methods for setting up a more general URL connection so that you can do more general I/O operations on documents that are available from the web server. And then even more general, which we won't have time to discuss here, is setting up a socket link with a program or with a program on the web server host that your applet might be connected to, or more in general for Java applications, a socket with any other host. So if you're not familiar with socket programming, essentially what a socket does is set up, enable you to set up any number of I/O streams which stay sort of permanently defined between your Java application and some other program on another host machine. Now, a lot of the design of Java was aimed at making sure that Java applets couldn't access memory outside of its own states on the browser machine. So that in Java applications that run as standalone programs, you can do all the I/O, you can do file I/O. In Java applets, you're not allowed to do I/O on the local machine except as you might be able to do it through the browser. So you can't read and write files on the client machine. If somebody connects to your web page and you have an applet and download it, your applet can't, you know, destroy files on their machine, and so on. And so far, aside from downloading native code, we don't know of anybody that's actually done that. The other restriction that's currently in all the browsers is that you can't, the applet can't communicate with any other network host besides the web server that the applet code came from. So this is a real restriction. The applet can only connect back to the web server machine. So here's a discussion of the various kinds of Java programs and exactly which file and network access properties that they have. But let's go on to talking about how to use a URL on a web server machine to be able to access documents or to read files there. So I think we mentioned before that you can actually, that there is a constructor for a class called URL with all capital letters. One of the things you can give the constructor is a string which is supposed to be a well-formed URL. And what this constructor does is create an internal representation of the URL and check to make sure that it is, in fact, well-formed. So one of the things that can happen is it can generate an exception, malformed URL exception, if you give it a string which isn't properly formatted to be a URL. Then the simplest thing to do is to use a method called showDocument, which if you give it a URL and an optional frame argument, if you don't give the frame argument, it just displays it in the current window, which will display in the browser window the whatever document the URL was pointing to. So that's a really simple thing. It's like having links on an HTML page. You just use the URL, you say show document, and up it pops. But more generally, you might want to use, to look at documents or files on the web server machine and to read the contents and process them, do something internally with the contents of the file. So if you have a URL, one of the methods that you have is you can say open stream. And that will open, it will return a stream in which the source is the file that's given by the URL on the web server machine, and the destination is your applet. So that your applet can have methods then which can read data from this stream from any file on the web server. More generally, you can also say open connection on a URL, and that one of the things you can do with that is open a stream, but in addition, you have more methods that enable you to do other things. Note that you can connect to anything that's a URL, not just HTML files, but other kinds of files and CGI programs, so that you sort of have full HTTP connectivity, whatever the web server could do. So I think I have time for just one last example that puts together these ideas to just show you code which is actually going to read the contents of a file using the OpenStream method with a URL on the web server. So this applet is called ReadStream, and it has a thread, so it's implements runnable. It has as instance variables a variable for the URL, a variable for the thread, and a variable for a text area in which we're going to display the contents of the file that we're going to read. So the point of this applet is to connect to a URL, read the contents of the file, and then we're simply going to display it in a text area. So here's the init function of the applet, and it's the one that uses the URL constructor to construct the URL. And in this case, instead of giving the entire string that's the URL is the HTTP address, you're also allowed with this constructor to use an alternate thing where you use that handy get codebase function that we saw when we were talking about images, which has the part of the URL that gets you up to the applet directory, the directory that the applet came from, and then if you have a file in that directory, then you just give its name here. And this will construct a URL that has the URL of the applet directory plus gets to this file. We set a layout to see a border layout for no particular reason because we only have one thing to add, which is the text area. So the text area, we set the font, and we add it to the center of this border layout. We have the standard start and stop methods for applets that have threads. And I should mention, of course, that the reason that we want this applet to have a thread is that it can be quite a lengthy thing reading data from a file because you're going to have possible network delays. And so this is an example of an applet which is going to take a long time possibly to compute, and you want to make sure that it has a thread. So the main part of the applet will be in the run method, like we saw before with applets with threads. We introduce a variable that's going to be a data input stream, and I introduce a variable that's going to be a string buffer. Now, in the text area, I'm going to use the setText method to actually put in various messages so that the user doesn't get bored waiting for the entire file to download and knows what's happening. So before I try to do the OpenStream method, I set the initial text to be OpenStream. And actually on the previous slide there was a text that I put in at the very time that I created the text area as well. Now we do the OpenStream method on the URL that we created in the init method, and we convert it, like we said before, to a buffered input stream, and then we convert that to a data input stream. So we need the buffer for good performance, and we need the data input stream because we want to use a more structured method than just read a character at a time. So now we put our informative message in the text area with setText to be reading data. And now the next while loop is going to read the entire file. So the main thing here is that this variable data is a data input stream, and one of the methods we're allowed to use on a data input stream is called readLine. And it reads the entire line from the file up to the next new line character that's in the file. So as long as the line we read is not null, which would be the end of the file, we keep going around this loop and we append the line that we read to the string buffer with a new line character. Because readLine doesn't bring in the new line character. So after the while loop, we have actually read the entire file, and we just, it's all in this string buffer called buff. So we use the method, the handy method toString on buff, which converts the contents of the string buffer to a string, and then we set it into the text area. So notice that here is an example of using a string buffer that was quite handy because we wanted to keep appending to an existing string, and that made us keep getting a bigger and bigger string. So that's why we used the string buffer. Notice also that in some sense this is not a very interesting program, because it just reads the whole file and puts it in the text area. It's just an example of the kind of thing you might do. Probably what you really want to do is, instead of reading all the lines at once, is to read the file one line at a time and do some processing on the string that represents each line every time you read it. It's a more general kind of program that you would have. So that's all I'm going to cover tonight, and our time is pretty much over, so I guess I haven't left time for Jeffrey to say any global remarks about Java and its place in the world. So next time you're going to go ahead and start JavaScript, is that right? And there will be one more homework on Java, which we will assign next week. You're working now on your first Java program, and most of you, except for one person that I know of, has their account, is that right? I have the account list here if anybody didn't get theirs last time. You have to copy it down, your initial account and password. So any other questions? Yes. is the fifth Wednesday? Yes. The first and second, the first assignment was to make a class web page.